Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Dying Sports Podcast on the Dying Sports Podcast Network. We are back after a brief hiatus, took a little week off because we've got quite a few projects in the go. So we've got some big news. You can check out our social media pages if you want to follow along with some of the announcements that we've got coming up. Just get a little teaser right now. Not going to announce what we've got in the works, but pretty soon you'll see some of the things that we've been working on, and we're very excited about that. So make sure to toss us a follow at Dying Sports across any of the major social media platforms for more info on that. Jam-packed episode, though, today. So we're going to make up for being off last week. We have got three interviews today for you. We're going to be starting off with Brendan Gylanders from the Ottawa Red Blacks, fresh off signing his brand new contract. We're actually the first interview he did. So eat your heart out, TSN Sportsnet is the Dying Sports Podcast Network that's getting the first exclusive with him there. We talk all things CFL this Red Blacks season. He just welcomed a baby into the world. So what it's like joining the fatherhood club and more. Then we've got author of Hockey 365 and Hockey 365, the second period, Mike Comito, who's going to sit down with us and talk about his two books that he's got out on the market, as well as the state of the Toronto Maple Leafs, as he is a diehard Leafs fan himself. Then last but not least, we are going to be sitting down with Brad Wilson to talk all things sports card. He is from TSG Sports Cards, and he does live breaks and all sorts of stuff on the content production side of the sports and collectibles market. So we're going to talk about the state of sports memorabilia, some of the things that have developed over the course of the pandemic, the skyrocketing prices, values going through the roof, delays in grading, delays in shipments, all of that and more. So jam-packed episode. Let's get right into it. Up first, Brendan Gylanders from the Ottawa Red Blacks. Sitting down with us today, we've got former Ottawa U GG 2016 Grey Cup champion and running back for the Ottawa Red Blacks, Mr. Brendan Gylanders. How are you tonight, sir?
I'm good, thanks. How are you doing?
Not bad. I'm glad you could take a little bit of time out from dominating the Pods versus Pros Fantasy Football League to sit down with us and talk about the CFL season. You're just running away with the league right now.
Yeah, no, it's going well. That's for sure. I'm pretty psyched, but it's, you know, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. So we'll see.
Yeah, there you go. Couple reasons to congratulate you, though. Obviously, football-wise, it was announced just today, you and a couple of your teammates inked some new contracts. So first and foremost, congratulations on that. You'll be coming back to the nation's capital. How do you feel about getting that out of the way with not even really the off season?
Yeah, man. Thank you. Thank you. The timing of this just kind of worked out perfectly. You guys are the first exclusive interview I've got going on, other than talking to a couple guys after practice. So, yeah, no, thank you. I really appreciate that. I mean, I'm obviously super, super excited to be back. This off season is a little bit different than previous, obviously, with the departure of Marcel happening a couple weeks ago and not really knowing what's going to go on with the front office or the coaching staff. There's a lot of unknown variables, but I mean, the one thing that I do know is I absolutely love this city, and we've got a lot of great guys that are already coming back. Obviously, there have been a few re-signings, and that doesn't happen without, you know, a strong core and guys that get along and want to play each other. So obviously a lot has to change, because this season wasn't the way we wanted it to turn out by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, I'm excited to be part of the solution.
Yeah, and if we follow that train of thought there as well too, you already mentioned on field, not the results that you guys have wanted, currently 2-11. Some big changes happened in the front office with Marcel Desjardins being let go by the team. What was maybe your just relationship with Marcel, and what was your first reaction when you even heard the news?
You know, I always respected Marcel. He took a lot of heat in the press and in the public opinion. You know, I mean, the things that I can speak to directly are that negotiating, he was always upfront and honest with me. We never had any issues whatsoever. I mean, this is the third or fourth contract I've done with Ottawa, and I've honestly had nothing but good things to say about the front office. So he was always pleasant to deal with from that standpoint. And, you know, he's a guy that, like you said, in a game of front offices, and I've been around a couple now, finding upfront honesty from the guy that runs it all, you know, it can be hard to find. So I always respected him for that. And obviously he was never the most affectionate guy to deal with and stuff like that, but it's a business, and that's how he is. Take him how he is. So, you know, I'm not going to get into any of the business side or anything like that, but I only have good things to say about Marcel. We texted for a little bit after he was let go, and you know, I think it would be unjust if as players, and I mean anyone who's been around since 2016 when we were in the Grey Cup, like myself, it's not fair to be pointing fingers if you're also not looking in the mirror. So I think that anytime you're in a position like he is, it's tough, and obviously somebody has to be held accountable for it, but at the end of the day, we're all accountable for that. So
yeah, no, absolutely. It's never easy, regardless of whether it's the minor leagues, whether it's the CFL. Like, it really doesn't make it any easier having to let someone go that's been around the team for so long, that's got ties to the city. But like you said, there's a litany of factors, and I'm sure one day we'll get a book written about it or something. But for now, wish Marcel all the best. On to a bit of a happier note here. You, off field, just recently welcomed a son into the world with your wife. So congratulations on that. What's life like as a new father?
Busy. Busy, yeah. You know, in a perfect world, we have babies in the off season and we get to spend time with them and stuff like that. Obviously it didn't work out that way. But you know, my wife, in all honesty, all the credit to her, she's been an absolute, saint through this whole thing. She does most of the night shift. So if I'm up early and training, or the night before a game or something like that, she makes sure that I get enough sleep. And, you know, yeah, so it's been tough. It's been a big adjustment, but you know, like I said, my wife's done an amazing job, making sure that I'm able to do what I do on a day in, day out. And you know, my son Jacob too is an absolute champ. He's 10 weeks old right now and slept for 7.5 hours through the night the first time we put him down last night. So he's being a team player through the whole thing too.
Well, yeah, hopefully that trend continues and he doesn't revert back in the off season and you're up all night with him. But kudos to the wives, because I honestly don't know how they do it. They do yeoman's work there for sure, and they definitely take the brunt of it. But I mean, I'm essentially a zombie on a good day if I get broken sleep with, you know, the babies in the night. I've got two daughters of my own, so I've lived that experience for sure. But I couldn't imagine trying to do that and then have a 250-pound linebacker trying to decapitate you on the field, right? Like, how has it been just in the couple of weeks since you've come back from helping to deliver the baby and trying to adjust back into that locker room and get that mentality right to take the field again when you're maybe not functioning at 100% sleep and all of that good stuff?
Yeah, I mean, you do what you got to do. I mean, you're kidding yourself if you don't think other people have things going on too. So, I mean, it is what it is. I'm the type of person that I'm not going to make any excuses regardless of what the situation is. I mean, it's quite literally my job. It's what I get paid to do. So at the end of the day, you know, I can't look the other 43 guys that dress in the eyes if I can't show up and perform at 100%. So it's my job to find a way to make it happen. And like I said, all the credit goes towards my wife too. She's the rock at home that's making it easy for me to be able to do this. And you know, all I have to worry about on road games is missing the little guy. And like I said, the team's so supportive too. We've got a lot of guys that have young children at home, or are on to their second and third baby. And, you know, they were all pumped when Jacob was born, and same thing. We've got a couple due in the next couple weeks. Cleon's got a baby due any day now. Timothy Flanders also had a little baby girl just a couple weeks ago. RJ's got one due in December. So, you know, we're all kind of going through the same thing, and you know, it's kind of funny in a sense that guys that have been there before, like guys like Nigel with Luca and stuff like that, it's like they can share the experiences and I can kind of go to them for advice even. So you know, it's like I said, it's some days are easier than others, but you do what you got to do.
Yeah, Well, there you go. Everyone's due around the same time. Everyone had a little bit of extra spare time during the 2020 season.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, exactly.
You guys start a dad park group or something like that this off season. Take the kids down, push them on the swings, all that. It's got to be weird too, especially given the fact that there was no 2020 season to speak of, right? It was always on the brink of, okay, are we going to have a condensed season, a shortened season? Now it's just outright canceled. So no football last year. Fast forward to this year, you've got all these COVID protocols now in place. I mean, here even locally in Ottawa, for those that are listening that aren't familiar with the situation, even the Senators now have their next three games postponed because of an outbreak there. So shows how quickly these things can spread within a locker room environment. So walk us through, like, the week of a game, how many times are you guys getting tested? Like, what's the life of a CFL COVID protocol player? What do you have to go through to get from practice to actually taking the field on game day?
Yeah, so things are a lot different now than at the beginning of the season and even preseason. I mean, we're pretty much locked down on quarantine for 2 weeks prior to the start of training camp. And then in training camp, we were tested pretty much every other day, the entire training camp. And during that period, we weren't allowed to eat at restaurants. We weren't allowed to be in any social gathering whatsoever. So, I mean, we might as well still have been in quarantine. We're pretty much on the football field and then off. And so, I mean, that was tough. I mean, I know a lot of guys, I was supposed to be a groomsman in a wedding over that period, and I couldn't even attend, let alone be the groomsman. So, sacrifices like that were a little bit different than the usual. And now we get tested twice a week. I mean, I can say, like, with the Red Blacks, we haven't had one positive all year, actually. So, I mean, it's something to be proud of. And it's something that Coach Lapo at kind of echoed the sentiment right from the get-go. Like, it's us against COVID every single week, too. Because if we get into a situation where half the team can't go, it's if the CFL can't rework the schedule, that gives us loss. So, I mean, guys were super diligent about it. But it was one of those things where we weren't allowed eating indoors at the facility. Masks have to be worn all the time at the facility. You can only have a certain number of guys. All of our meeting rooms are completely changed. We really don't have any meetings together other than small positional groups. So, I mean, it's been a different year for sure. It's certain things like team bonding's been a little bit of a challenge. We've been chartering in and out right after games as well, whereas you normally get to stay two or three nights depending on the situation, and then you leave the next morning after away games. You get to go out with the team after. That's obviously not happening this season. So certain things, it's made communication within the offense and defensive position groups a little bit more challenging, because the O-line's meeting somewhere, running backs, receivers, quarterbacks, and then you kind of have to mesh it all together without actually being in the same meeting room. So it's been a challenge from that standpoint. And then, like I said, the team bonding has been a little bit different, because in training camp especially, we are so sectioned off. It's like you only really ever saw the same five people at a time other than at practice. So it was difficult to try and get to know each other as a team. So there's been struggles, but you know, it's one of those things that every team is in the same boat, right? And obviously like I said, whether it was adhering to protocols a little bit better, but there were some teams that got in a little bit of trouble and it cost them for sure going down the stretch. Edmonton's playing their second game in four days tonight, because they had a game postponed that had to get rescheduled. So, I mean, fortunately, we didn't get into a situation like that, but it's been different. But like I said, when everybody's in the same boat, you know, it's not an excuse. You just gotta figure out the best way to do it and go from there.
Well, I was going to say too, because if you look at even the Red Blacks roster, whether it's from free agent departures, retirements, whether it was trades, like there's a lot of turnover from this team to the pre-COVID team that you guys had, just personnel wise. So do you think that also played into maybe the slower start that you guys got off to, in the sense that some of those veteran teams that didn't really have much roster turnover, they've got their systems in place. So whether they're in different rooms or meeting via Skype or whatever, they've got that continuity there. Whereas you guys had a lot of new faces coming into that locker room this year, and it maybe took you guys a little bit longer to gel.
Yeah. I mean, that's any year though, in all honesty. Like it's honestly very difficult, and that's where the GM and the front office has a hard time doing it, because when you have a year like 2019, everyone wants to hit a panic button and bring in everybody new. But the reality is, anybody that's ever played professional sports will tell you that consistency breeds success. It's you need continuity and you need consistency. You need familiarity with the guys lining up next to you to build that chemistry. And that's what continues to build success. If you look at the teams that have had the most success in recent years, you're right. It's the teams with the least turnover. And that's not to be said that it can't be done. I mean, I'm not making excuses here. There's other teams that had a ton of turnover too that have a better record than us, but it certainly is one of the challenges for sure. And I mean, yeah, it's one of those things where you always walk a fine line between bringing a new talent in and trying to develop from within and just being able to try and build that continuity in the main guys on your roster.
So Friday, you guys have your last game of the year against Montreal. Unfortunately, you guys won't be moving on to the playoffs. So is this the game where you guys are really starting to lobby the coaches, the offensive coordinators, defense coordinators, whatever it is, to just throw the kitchen sink, all those gadget plays you've been saving all year that maybe you've talked about or run through in practice? Like, are we going to see anything special? Obviously, you don't have to reveal what the plays are, but have you guys been lobbying for some extra special plays getting into the playbook Friday?
I'll say no. I'll tell you this. I have a coach that I played for in university that I really respect that always used to say, if you can't beat them, you have to trick them. And that's kind of stuck around with me, that I don't want to have to trick anybody. I want to go out there and beat them one-on-one. So I, in all honesty, it's more of the same. It's just preaching the fundamentals and what we've been doing all year, and just executing better, finishing drives. You know, we've done a lot of good things, but we also haven't been consistent by any stretch of the imagination. And the one thing that I think you'll get to see is a lot more the younger guys being evaluated, and you know, I'm happy for them and they get their chance and stuff like that, because there's been a lot of talented guys that have been, whether it's a practice roster or just haven't gotten their chance out there on the field, that they should get an opportunity this game as well, and the coaches will have the opportunity to evaluate them as well. And if it's not here, it'll be other teams as well that get to evaluate them. So you know, it's one of those situations where people always say, oh, the game doesn't mean anything. Well, it might not mean anything for the record, but I guarantee you it means a whole lot for a lot of people. And it's more about who you are as a person, and if you are going to play red, black football, you better make sure that you finish the right way. And, you know, I think that we will. I think that we will. So I don't think that you can expect any gadget plays or anything like that. We're going out there to try and win and beat them the way it should be.
A lot of people playing for contracts, a lot of people trying to showcase talents for next season, evaluate the talent within the locker room for some of those guys who might not have gotten all the reps previously in some of the earlier season games and whatnot, for sure. Now, this offseason, I'm assuming fatherly duties are going to eat up a lot of your time, as newborns tend to do. But any big plans for the offseason? Do you have any projects on the go or anything like that?
I've got a couple projects going. I don't want to say too much, because I've got one big surprise that should be coming out this year. But I'm working with a group of companies based out of Ottawa and the GTA Ion Group, and they've been absolutely fantastic. And we've got something that I think is going to be really special coming out. And it's basically a charitable cause is all I'll say. And I think that it could really help our community here. So I'm excited to bring that to fruition. And yeah, like I said, all the thanks to Ion Group, because they're making it happen and giving me the resources to be able to do that. And then other than that, I'll do my normal guest coaching at a ton of different places.
Everywhere and anywhere.
Whoever will have me, exactly. It's just so I can hang out on the football field in the off season. And then I'm also going to be working with the past few off seasons. I've worked with Titan Performance out of the Ridgecraft Senseplex in the East. And I run their senior football group. So we do that three times a week, and then speed sessions on the weekend. So it keeps me just busy enough that I can concentrate on my own training and also get to help high school football players that have ambitions to go on and play U Sports football as well. So yeah, it keeps me connected with the community, keeps me in the gym, and I get to meet the next generation of ballers. So it's a win-win.
There you go. Pass on that knowledge to the youngsters for sure. All right. Well, Brendan, before we let you go, we're just going to fire some real quick rapid fire questions at you here, and then we'll let you get back to daddy daycare duties tonight. I know you've got bath time coming up. So starting off here, just really quickly, don't overthink it. Favorite city to play in other than Ottawa?
Vancouver.
Hardest hitter in the league. Can't pick a teammate.
Ooh. Hardest hitter. Man, I can't say who I want to say. I'll say Henock. Henock Mwamba.
Okay. Teammate you wouldn't want in charge of the locker room music under any circumstances.
Oh, there's a lot. I wouldn't want. I will say. I'll say Micah.
Okay. Which red blacks uniform combo is your personal favorite?
Ooh, this year I like the whites. I like the whites.
Liking the whites. All right. Which teammate has the most elaborate pregame ritual or superstitions?
Richie Leone.
Okay. What's your go-to pregame meal?
Normally I've been crushing chicken pad thai actually.
Oh yeah. You've been making it yourself or are you picking that up?
No, I pick it. There's a great spot on River Road. I drive in from Manitick and on River Road, it's a place called Angry Dragons and they have a fantastic chicken pad thai.
Well, there we go. Shout out to Angry Dragons there.
Yeah.
All right. Favorite sport other than football?
Golf.
Beautiful. And in 10 words or less, for any soon to be free agents out there, why should they consider signing in Ottawa this offseason?
Where's your last? Great city. We want to win. And, you know, it's a great group of guys, good coaching staff. I'm going to go over the 10 words, but nobody that I've talked to has ever said anything bad about Ottawa or regretting signing here. Everybody absolutely loves the city. The first thing people come into the city say is like, this is beautiful, especially the game day. Lansdowne, the way it's set up, there's honestly nothing else like it in the CFL, the way that Lansdowne is set up. And driving in and just seeing everywhere packed, you know, gets you pumped up 4 hours before kickoff. So that honestly is something special.
Yeah, definitely went past 10 words there, but yeah. There you go. Any impending free agents, we won't name names, we'll avoid any of the tampering charges, but any impending free agents, there's your reason for coming to Ottawa. Brendan, we appreciate the time you took tonight to sit down with us. Wish you all the best. For those that want to either connect with you on social media or check out any of the projects that you kind of teased a little bit earlier, like where are the best places to find you or any of the stuff you're going to be involved with?
Yeah, the easiest place to find me is on Instagram at Beaglanders. I'm also on Twitter, but I do more work stuff on there. Instagram's more of my day-to-day life. So if you want to come and hang out or drop me a message or something like that, that's the best spot.
Amazing. Well, again, thank you for taking the time and go give your wife a pat on the back and a congratulations from the Dine Sports Podcast. Enjoy fatherhood and best of luck this Friday.
Yeah, will do. Thanks so much, Kyle.
Before we get to our interview with Mike, want to remind everyone to head over to mybookie.ag for all of your online sports books needs. MyBookie has some of the friendliest lines across the internet, whether it's single game bets, futures bets, or multiple team parlays. They've got a little bit of everything for everyone. Make sure to use the promo code DYNESports, D-Y-N-E-S, sports with an S at the end of it, all one word, so that they know who sent you. Tonight's Dine Sports Podcast Parlay, we are going to do a triple header, all money lines in the NBA. We're going to take the Milwaukee Bucks to beat the Lakers, the Brooklyn Nets to beat the Cleveland Cavaliers, and the New York Knicks to beat the Orlando Magic. So that's Knicks, Nets, and Bucks, all in NBA action tonight. If you want to play along with us, feel free to. If you want to do your own thing, more power to you as well, too. Just whatever you do, make sure you're using the promo code DYNESports for first deposit bonuses, top-ups, and more. Must be 18 years of age or older. Please gamble responsibly. Now, our interview with Mike Comito.
Joining us on the podcast today, we've got author of Hockey 365 and Hockey 365, the second period, Mike Comito. How are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing well, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We're happy that you're here. Obviously, you've been a busy guy cranking out two books over the last little while. For those that are unfamiliar, though, or maybe you haven't heard of either of the books, kind of a unique format that you chose to do. So what's sort of the Coles Notes version of the inspiration behind the Hockey 365 series?
Yeah, so it's so as the name suggests, it's 365 short hockey history stories, one for every day of the year. So I like to compare it to a word of the day calendar where every day you kind of flip through, you get a new word that you get to incorporate into your vocabulary. This book in the two volumes, it's essentially a different hockey history moment. So notable goal scoring milestone or a trade or a transaction. I've now cataloged, 365 of them in two volumes. The second period came out at the end of September. And the inspiration for it actually kind of came about when I got into writing about hockey history. You know, about 6 or 7 years ago, I started to kind of build up this portfolio of stories I had written. And then I started incorporating daily moments in hockey history on my Twitter feed. And then as I kind of, I think, built up a decent collection of stories I had written, and obviously I've been doing the thing on Twitter, I kind of thought, like, this format seems to be working well on social media. The stories I'm writing are really interesting to me. And certainly there's a, rich audience of hockey history lovers out there. I thought, maybe there's a way to combine this into a book. And that's honestly how it first started in 2017 when I first started the process. And then, now here we are 4 years later from when I first wrote that book. And we've got the second period out. And what seems to be probably the logical endpoint of this series would at least be to get that third period out in probably a couple more years. And then, of course, there's overtime, sudden death, shootout. Like, the sky's the limit. There's certainly enough hockey history out there to fill multiple volumes. We'll just see how the publisher feels in a few years and how I feel. Because it's fun to write them, but it definitely takes a lot out of you to try to write 365 stories, right? So,
absolutely. And I mean, we've had a few authors on the show, and people tend to fall in one camp or the other. It's either I love this process from beginning to end, I can't wait to dive right into it, or it's that sucked the life out of me. I'm glad I did it, but I'm not hopping back into that process again anytime soon. So, with you now having released your second one, like, was the rationale for the second one coming out, you had so many leftover stories that you wanted to do that second book, or was it more of just a passion project of you fell into that former camp where you enjoyed it so much, you're going to crank this one out, can't wait to get into the next one? Where'd you sort of fall in that spectrum?
Yeah, so it was actually a mix of I think, both those perspectives. The first book did suck the life out of me. I'd never written a book before. And again, I had a really tight timeline. I signed the contract. The first draft of the book had to be submitted 6 months later. So I honestly spent like every free evening and a lot of spare time on the weekends writing that book. I obviously made the deadline. I was proud about that, as making that deadline. But after I was done, like, I was kind of done with it. And then after you get the first draft and there's still the editing, the revisions, the proofing. So that process still kind of, you get a little bit of a reprieve when you submit it, but then, you're back into it. And at that point, you're dealing with somebody offering up, criticism and constructive feedback on your work, which, is obviously its own process as well. So I was happy when it was done, obviously, especially when you can kind of hold it in your hands and see like all that blood, sweat and tears that went into it is there. And I always knew that after writing that first book, there was a ton that I wasn't able to include. Obviously, you kind of pick and choose what you wanted to include in the first one. I said, there's so much hockey history out there that we could definitely do multiple volumes. And it's funny, when the first book came out in 2018, I said to the publisher, like, when can we do the next one? Despite the fact that it was a tough process, I was looking forward to doing it again at some point, obviously with enough of a break. But the reason I ended up doing the second one when I did was not actually because like I wanted to jump into it again so quickly. It was timing. At this point, in April of 2020, the pandemic was just kind of rearing its ugly head. And I've been doing a lot of work for the LA Kings and the Sudbury Wolves over for the last 3 years. And so at that point, I had been kind of furloughed by the team for a lot of the freelancing work that I'd done for both clubs. And so I kind of thought that I was getting into the summertime with no, hockey returning at any time soon. I thought this might be the best time to jump into a book project, because it's a solitary endeavor. You don't get to share with the world for, months and years after the fact. So like, at least when you're writing online stories, you write them and then probably a week or two later, you can share them with the world and you can kind of, pass them on to the readers. Whereas a book, you're like kind of locked in a vault for a long time, right? So I figured, with me probably not doing anything for the Kings and the Wolves for a long time, this is like really the probably the only opportunity I'm going to get to really just work on a project like this. And so that's how it honestly happened, was I just thought, let's kind of start this. I started quietly on my own, and then I brought the publisher into the conversation in the summer of 2020. They agreed that the timing was right to do a second volume, and that's honestly how it happened. And it was much more enjoyable the second time around, because I think having gone through it the first time, I knew what to expect. I knew how to like balance my schedule a little bit more. And I just had a little bit more fun because I knew that I had to kind of think outside the box for some of these stories, because I already covered 365 of them in the first one.
Yeah, well, I can imagine too that after you've released the first one and people obviously enjoyed it and they've read it and they get wind that, oh, I'm starting to work on a second one. Like, how many people came forward to you with, hey, here's an idea for something that should be included, or I've got a story, or you should look into this? Like, how much of that was crowdsourced versus this is just, as you said, solitary endeavor? I did everything from all 365 of them myself.
No, I think it was great to get feedback from people. I think even like with friends and family would say like, why didn't you include that in the first book? And I said, well, you know, there's a reason I wanted to include that one. And, you know, there'll be other opportunities. I don't know when, but I'll include it. And, you know, I think it's fun to see the response when you have a book out there. And so I knew that going into the second process, I definitely called out to, you know, to people on social media to say, what's your favorite hockey history moment, to find a way to incorporate into the book. And again, I think, you know, a lot of people had stories that were featured in the first book, but there were a lot of people that said, you know, this is a story that's, you know, has a special meaning for me. And so I did try to take some of those stories that I received online and put them into the book. I think that's the beauty of hockey history, is that everyone has a different piece that they connect to. And so I think, you know, getting some feedback and trying hopefully to incorporate some of that into the book, hopefully that anyone who picks this up, you know, sees a piece of at least, you know, the teams that they follow, or the players they grew up watching, reflected in some of these stories.
Yeah, well, 730, I guess, hockey stories out there now to choose from. But if you were to try and, I mean, it's going to be a tough task, but boil down a Mount Rushmore, so maybe a top three or four stories that have really affected the course of where we are with hockey as a sport today. Like, are there ones that stand out more than the others that... obviously, not every story is built equally here, but are there some that you can really point to as these are pivotal moments in hockey history?
Yeah, no, there's certainly a few where I focused on some of the rule changes. Again, I think when you look back to when the NHL was formed in 1917, like the game has come a long way. You know, I think back even when the NHL was playing against, you know, the Pacific Coast Hockey Association for the Stanley Cup, like they were playing by two separate sets of rules in the Stanley Cup final. You'd play by the West Coast rules, where they'd have an additional player on the ice that kind of acted as a rover. They could do limited forward passing, whereas in the NHL, they didn't have any of that yet, right? So I did include stories like that, where I had the inclusion of the forward pass in the first book. You know, I've had other rule changes that I think are fundamental, you know, to the game's progression. That's a really good question. No one's really asked me that before, because I can't, you know, off the top of my head, I'd love to be able to pick, other than, you know, the forward pass, which I think is a huge one. You know, it's there's so many stories there. And again, they're not all part of, I think, NHL lore. I've tried to include some stuff from international hockey, you know, the minor leagues, some women's hockey history as well. So yeah, I'd love to say that I had something off the top of my head ready to go, but other than the rule changes, I think there's stories that are dependent on what kind of who you root for and which team you cheer for. Certainly you could argue that this moment is more significant, but I think overall, you know, to the game of hockey from a historical perspective, I always go back when people ask me about these stories that, you know, do they surprise you after all these years? I always think back to the rule changes, because I think it's always telling when we talk about things today, like how do you increase scoring and changing goalie equipment and things like that. And people always say, well, you can't do that. You know, you got to protect the purity of the game. And it's like the game looked nothing like it did when it was, you know, founded before the NHL. And then obviously when the NHL was founded, it's just evolved incredibly since then, right? So I think that's always the thing that I go back to, is just how I think much we take for granted, how much the sport has actually evolved just over in the last 100 years.
And that's a great point too, right? Because if you look at the stories that you have chosen to include, like, it's not all just cut and dry stats, like, oh, on this day, so-and-so scored his 700th goal or whatever. Like, you also delve a little bit into some pop culture and some other things that are a little bit broader than just hockey. So when you're starting to comb through these stories, like, were there some really good stories that either piqued your interest because they were just so strange or unbelievable that they had happened, didn't end up making either of the final volumes, but any that stood out to you as this was just an enjoyable thing that I happened to stumble across? Not sure if it's worthy of making it into a book though.
No, I think actually this time around, those things that I came across, like they made it into the book, because I think what was different from the first book was that I was kind of just working to like put together 365. And I keep saying 365, but there is that extra story for leap year. So there is 366, but obviously 366 doesn't have the same ring to it. But with the first book, I was just trying to get all those stories kind of figured out so I could start writing them. But with this, when I knew that the first book was done, in the 3 years that followed, you kind of start to think about them in a different way. And you're like, huh, that's an interesting story. I'd never come across it before. I'd put it into an Excel sheet and kind of start filing away these ideas for when we got to the second book. And then even, you know, there's stories when you're doing research, you uncover a different angle or a different story that you weren't even looking for. And so there was actually one example where I forget what story I was researching, but I came across another story in the newspaper at the time. And it was about when Harry Neal was coaching in the WHA, and he got into an altercation when his team, he was coaching the Whalers at the time, and they were playing against the Birmingham Bulls. And I guess towards the end of the game, the Whalers were, you know, about to win the game and the fans were getting pretty rowdy. And he took a stick and he kind of swung it, you know, towards the fans' direction. He ended up like hitting three of these fans, including one happened to be an old lady. And he left that night, like the police were trying to get after him in the dressing room. And, you know, he talked to his lawyer and his lawyer said, you need to get out of town. And they were obviously in Alabama at the time. So under the cover of darkness, he went to Atlanta and then he went home because he was worried that they're going to issue an arrest warrant for him. And eventually they did. The woman that came forward, you know, brought charges against Harry Neal. When they went back to Alabama later that season, he went before the court and the charges were thrown out. But that was an example where I hadn't planned on including that story. I think we all know, or some of us are familiar with the Harry Neal story, you know, against the Nordiques game at the Colisée where they climbed into the stands and he got suspended for 10 games. So I thought this is too perfect that obviously that happens, you know, this moment in the WHA happens, you know, 10 years or so before the Vancouver moment. And so you kind of have to put those together, but that's another happy accident where I wasn't looking for that Harry Neal story. And of course I had to include it because, you know, anytime a coach gets involved with the fans, it's going to be an interesting yarn for sure.
Yeah. Well, that's the one end of the spectrum, right? Is the happy accident. You stumble upon something that's sort of the opposite end, though, would be there's some legends and folk tales and stuff that goes from dressing room to dressing room. And, oh, this was the hilarious story or this time. And they sort of get exaggerated. So were there any stories that you had come across that once you started doing some research or maybe even talked to the people that were involved, you found out that the version that you had heard that piqued your interest wasn't anywhere near as interesting as what ultimately ended up happening?
Yeah, no, there's actually a pretty, I think, well-known version of that and that's the night when, you know, Maurice Richard goes out and he scores 5 goals and he adds, you know, 3 assists, sets an NHL record for most, you know, goals and points in a night. But the folklore behind that story is that he moved into a new, you know, apartment that same day in Montreal, moved his family across town, you know, hauled all the furniture in, and then he went out that night and played that game, right? And it's been, I think, part of hockey history lore. There's even a Heritage Minute about it where they've got, you know, like a reenactment of him hauling himself up the stairs and then going out and obviously having an incredible game. And I think we've all kind of taken that moment as that's just what happened, right? And then as I was doing research for that story, because, you know, I'm familiar with that story, familiar with the Heritage Minutes, I found a Dave Stubbs article. Dave Stubbs works for the NHL. He does a lot of great hockey history for the league. And he did some work during the pandemic and he found an interview that Maurice Richard had given with a French language newspaper many years after that. And he said that that didn't happen the same day, that actually he had done the move the day before. So the day of the game, he wasn't actually moving his furniture across town the way that we all think. And so I don't think it takes anything away from what he did on the ice that night, because I think 5 goals and 8 points is still pretty incredible. And I think it makes just all of us feel a little bit more human that, you know, after a night of moving into a new house or an apartment, if all you did was sit on the couch and have a beer, that's okay, because not everybody goes out and scores 5 goals. And so that was one where I think obviously you could have gone with, you know, the mythologized version of that and just talked about what he did. But I think, you know, as a historian, it's always, I think you have a duty to try to obviously put together the most accurate and factual version of events as you can. And so when I did include that story, I did talk about the work that Dave had done, you know, to kind of set the record straight. And so that's part of that story where, again, I don't think it takes any shine off what Richard had done, but it certainly, I think, puts it in a different light.
Yeah, it's not as sexy of a heritage moment, 30-second commercial there. And then at the end of the day, he had a good night's sleep, and then he went into the rink the next day.
Yeah.
When you're not busy writing, though, you are yourself a very avid hockey fan, and us being an Ottawa podcast, we won't hold it against you that you are a Toronto Maple Leafs fan, but we'll talk a little bit about the Leafs right now, because they've kind of had an interesting start to the season, right? They've got the slow start. They're 8-2 in their last 10, so they've figured something out. Is it really as simple as they got Austin Matthews back and he is just the straw that stirs that drink? Or is there something that you've noticed in watching this team as of late that you can sort of pinpoint as, okay, they figured this out that they weren't doing through their first 5 or 6 games of the season?
Yeah, no, it's interesting because you go back and you, from my perspective in Leafs Twitter land, I guess you could see there was a lot of doom and gloom, as if I think a lot of people thought, like, you know, this was the end of the world, you know, 4 or 5 games into the season. And certainly I think it's kind of like, I'm not going to jump on that too early because it's a long grind. I don't think anybody had, you know, concerns going into the season that they're not going to make the playoffs. I'm more concerned about what do they do in April? Like, let's worry about that because that's when it matters. So, I mean, watching those games, though, there was, I think, a couple moments early into the season where, you know, it seemed as though Marner was kind of getting his confidence back. There was a game where he was making those plays that I think we're accustomed to Marner making, and he wasn't really doing those in the first few games of the season. And again, it's I don't want to, you know, reduce it down to he got his game back and now he's Mitch Marner again, but he has looked like Mitch Marner in the last like 10 games or so, right? And so I think certainly if you look back, you know, Austin Matthews, obviously, you know, he's returned now to the lineup as well and he's scoring, but I think you're getting, you know, production from the big four as well, right? Nylander's been a beast from out the gate up until now. Tavares has been finding the net. I think it's interesting now because, you know, there's always a tendency just to kind of overanalyze things. And, you know, I saw a stat recently where they showed like the last 10 goals the Leafs have had, and by and large, they're from, you know, their big four. And then people are saying, well, is that good or is that bad? If they're only getting production from the big four, because if the big four aren't producing, then who's chipping in those goals, right? So, you know, I think it's great that you now have the players you're playing the most money for or chipping in offensively. I think the matter as well is that when they're going, but I think it's still going to be the issue, you know, that we even saw last year, is that when those guys aren't going, who's chipping on the offense, right? Because certainly, you know, through the 82 games, they can't expect it night in, night out that they're going to be lighting the lamp to the frequency that they are. And then obviously in the playoffs, it's a whole other animal. But I think when they're going, the team is going, but it's got to be, you know, an all hands on deck, and they've got to get that scoring from, you know, from the middle six as well.
Dubas and Shanahan, the Shanahan plan, has been pretty adamant about and not hiding the fact that we are all in with these four guys. If they're not producing, then we're in a world of trouble here, and their salaries reflect that. So if we're to maybe put the four of them aside, though, who are some of the Leafs that you've been impressed with this season, just in the small sample size that we've seen in the first 16 games or so?
Yeah, to be honest, like, I'll say that Jack Campbell, only because I think last year you weren't really sure what to make of what had happened. You know, I think that, you know, given his trajectory in the NHL so far, you know, there was a part of me, and maybe this is just a cynical Leafs fan of me, that thought, was this just like a magical run and this is never going to be repeated again? And we're going to see, you know, the Jack Campbell that we'd seen, you know, throughout his journey through the NHL from a high draft pick to kind of becoming a backup. And to be honest, it's like, you never know when the wheels are going to fall off, but watching him play, I think I have the confidence saying that this maybe wasn't just this magical run that we kind of put it all together in the Canadian division. And I think, you know, watching him play, I think is just kind of, it's been inspiring to watch. So, I mean, that's one player who I think I've really kind of went into the season, not thinking that, you know, it was going to come crashing down, but I think I was cautiously optimistic that this may not go, you know, the way that it does. And I think there's been a lot of nights where like, they're not even in those games if he's not playing the way that he's been playing. Right. So he certainly, I think, helped them out a lot on the nights before, you know, those big four got going and chugging along. And so, again, I don't want to say that's a cop-out answer, because obviously he's a player I think we've all been watching since what he did last year. But I think myself kind of going into the season was a little unsure if we'd be able to replicate, you know, what he did that last season.
Well, obviously we're in Olympic year this year as well, too. Campbell's off to a hot start. Suddenly there's some buzz around, oh, well, could he be on the American Olympic roster? Like, do you put any stock in the fact that, he's got a legitimate shot and I think they'll take a long, hard look at them? Or do you think this is just Leafs fans getting themselves worked up into a frenzy because he's the goaltender for one of the largest market teams in the entire league?
Yeah, I mean, the Leafs fans definitely do have a tendency to do that. So I think that's certainly part of it. I think even the Leafs fans are paying attention to what there's like. I think even Hyman's name has been kind of brought up in the conversation. Is he a dark horse to make Team Canada as well because of, you know, the chemistry he's had, you know, potentially out in Edmonton? And so I think you can kind of build up a lot of these cases. I think him playing in a big market team like that and being showcased doesn't help. I think obviously Team USA, unlike, Team Canada, I think their position in net is a little more solidified. I mean, you've got Hellebuck, Gibson, and then maybe you've got Campbell in this mix now, but certainly I think, they've got a lot of solid options there as well. I think is Campbell playing his way into the conversation? I think, sure. Like why not? If this continues and he seems to be, you know, leading the pack, by that time at the midway point of the season, why not? But again, as a Leafs fan, I try to stay as grounded as I can.
Yeah. Pump the brakes every now
and
then. Yeah. You mentioned it before. There was an uproar in the early season, some serious questions getting asked as far as, okay, is Dubas's plan just now out the window? Can we win this? Obviously winning cures a lot of things. That's died down here now, but let's say you do hit another rough patch or it's another first round exit in the playoffs. Like how much longer of a leash do you think Dubas has in Toronto? Or do you think so long as Brandon Shanahan is in place, Kyle's his guy and he's not going anywhere?
Yeah. I mean, I think if they don't get out of the first round this offseason or this in the playoffs, that I think there'll be some changes. I can't imagine that if they suffer another first round exit, that the fans will be content with coming back in September and October with the status quo. Something's got to give there. Right. And I mean, it's hard to say how they would do that because clearly this is a team that has Dubas's fingerprints all over it. You know, Keefe is his guy. So again, it's not as if you can just, the GM is gone, but he's still the architect of this team. Right. So then what do you do? I think there's obviously he's done a great job at building the team. But honestly, yeah, it kind of comes down to, can they finally get over that hump, you know, in the playoffs? And I think that's going to be the biggest challenge, right? If this group can kind of rise above that and find a way to win, you know, when it matters, like you said, winning changes a lot of things. I think certainly, you know, when you look back at what happened to the Canadians last year, that could have been a case where Bergevin, you know, I think he was on the hot seat and he's probably still on the hot seat right now. But you go on a Stanley Cup final run and, you know, suddenly you've got some job security, right? So, you know, is that right or wrong? I mean, I think they kind of, you know, lucked into a lot of that with that magical run that they had. But I do think that there is pressure now. I think that, I think Leaf fans want to see, more than just, it's not good enough just to make the playoffs anymore. There needs to be that evolution in getting towards the ultimate goal of winning a Stanley Cup.
Yeah, no, I think Mark Bergevin is sitting on his hot seat is more of like a microwave there. It gets hot and then it cools off really fast and then it can heat up again very, very quickly. But all right, so $1 million question here before we let you go then. If you had to choose one thing that needs to change if the Leafs are actually going to advance past the first round of the playoffs in God knows how long here, what was the one thing that you've noticed over the past couple versions of this playoff Leafs team that needs to change this year if they advance?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, obviously it's having those big four all produce together. Again, you know, to use your phrase, like Matthews is the straw that stirs the drink. So if he's not going, you know, the other guys have to step up. And if things are going wrong with those other guys, obviously you're pushing that boulder up the hill. Obviously I think if you look back at last year, you can make the case that some of those guys were hurt. And I think obviously with Tavares getting knocked out the way that he did, you know, that was pretty horrific. And I think, you know, if that hadn't happened, you know, maybe we're having a whole different conversation right now. Maybe we're still having the same conversation, but obviously under different circumstances. But I think if they kind of get into, you know, the postseason, hopefully, you know, all those big guns are firing, everyone's healthy. You know, I think that's the best chance they have. Again, I don't know what it is, if there's any kind of pep talk. I mean, if you've watched the All or Nothing documentary, I thought that Keefe did a really good job at setting the stage to go out after intermission. And I mean, if you're not going to get motivated by that, then I don't know what else to say. So I think it's just a matter of if they're all firing and if they can somehow stay healthy, which is hard to do in the playoffs, then I think that should be enough the way that this team is constructed, that again, they've got the goaltending, and they've got the firepower. So if they can get it all together at the same time and stay healthy, they've got a good chance as anybody. But again, It just all depends on who they match up against. There's a sick part of me that wants them to obviously play Boston and just, you know, have that cathartic moment where they finally beat them. And then that's the thing that kind of galvanizes them to move forward, because I still feel if they don't beat Boston, they haven't really exercised that demon fully. And maybe that's the thing that they need to do, you know, to kind of really get over the hump. I think about Vancouver when they finally beat Chicago in 2011, and obviously they didn't win the cup that year, but that seemed like that moment where they finally, after Chicago had been tormenting them for several years in a row, they finally got through Chicago and then went to the final. Obviously it didn't turn out the way that I think Canucks fans would have liked, but it was almost like kind of that slaying the dragon type moment that Leafs need to have, I think, in order to kind of move forward with continued success.
Yeah, there you go. So Leafs need to beat Boston in the playoffs. Sens need to beat the Leafs in the playoffs. It's a vicious triangle there that if either of them are ever going to hoist the cup there, they need to exercise those demons, as you say. So, Mike, we appreciate you taking the time to sit down with us and talk some hockey, talk some books. For those that are listening, though, that want to connect with you online, pick up a copy of your book, check out any of the other work you're putting out into the world these days, where are the best places to find you?
Sure, yeah. The best place to find me is on Twitter. It's at Mike Comito. That's where I post any of the additional stories that I write for the Kings or the Wolves, and where you can find most of the links I have for my book. But otherwise, if you want to pick up a copy of the book, you can grab it wherever you like to buy books. It's available at Chapters or Indigo in Canada, Amazon, or wherever you like to get books. If you have a local independent bookseller in your town, go in, talk to them. If they don't have it, they can order it in for you. It makes a great Christmas gift for any hockey fan in your life. I'll just throw it out there, though.
Holidays are just around the corner there. Yeah. You always have to factor in shipping and all of that good stuff. If you haven't already, go out and pick up copies of either Hockey 365 or Hockey 365 the second period, or if you're nuts, get both of them at the same time. But Mike, we appreciate you coming on. Best of luck, and we'll connect again in the future.
Awesome. Thanks, Kyle. Appreciate it.
Before we sit down with Brad to talk all things sports cards, want to remind everyone, if you haven't already, check out dinespressbox.com. Our content team is constantly pumping out new articles, videos, podcast episodes, and more. It's your one-stop shop for anything sports related. And while you're there, be sure to click on the shop button to get taken over to the Fanatics website with pre-populated promo codes to take advantage of some massive holiday deals. Don't know if you know this already or not, Christmas just around the corner, so the holiday season is sneaking up upon us. Got to factor in those shipping times, so be sure to check out dinespressbox.com. And if you want to pick up some merchandise for the sports fan in your life, make sure to hit that shop button. Now, Brad Wilson.
Joining us today on the podcast, we've got Brad Wilson from TSG Cards. Brad, how are you doing tonight?
Doing great, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
Going to talk a little bit about sports collectibles, and obviously during the pandemic, kind of got a bit of a renaissance there. It seems like everyone started digging out their old cards from shoe boxes or venturing up to the attic and seeing what grandpa had stored up there. Yeah. And I mean, when did you really get started yourself in sports cards collecting? And was it during the pandemic and recent development, or has this been going on since childhood for you?
It started way back when I was playing hockey at 4 years old, and back at here in Ottawa, Walter Baker had the little slot machines. You throw a quarter in and out pops a couple hockey cards. So it started way back then. And growing up, I kind of forgot about the collecting I did as a kid until recently, when my parents dusted off a few things in their basement, found a bunch of binders and stacks of hockey cards. And it was about a month into the pandemic that I just started to pick it up and said, oh, this is kind of cool. You know, what did I miss in the last 10, 15 years that I haven't been collecting cards for? And it quickly became into a really, really passionate hobby of mine, one that I've just wanted to learn more and more about. And then, well, I guess you could say fortunately or unfortunately, prices skyrocketed, demand skyrocketed, supplies for the companies started to dwindle. So there's been tons of storylines around that, but it's kind of been a rejuvenated childhood hobby of mine.
At the height of the pandemic here, we went from, especially some of the topper end cards, 10 timing the prices that they were only a couple months before. So like a massive, massive spike in the market, obviously renewed interest, and the advent of, we've now got platforms like eBay and, you know, checkout mycards.com and stuff like that. So it's become easier for people to get their hands on what they want. So that all factors into these prices going up. But really, like, now that we're, knock on wood here, we're coming towards the end of the pandemic, the market's cooled a little bit, we've already seen the prices drop. Where do you think the prices are really going to settle when all is said and done? Like, are they going to be maybe twice what they were a while back? Or are we going to see another boom come out when some new sets start getting released after all these back orders? Like, what do you think is just going to be the market for sports cards moving forward?
Well, I think it is quite fascinating, and I personally focus a lot on hockey cards, and hockey cards make up about 1% of the sports card market, because the US dominates with basketball and baseball and football cards. And it really actually works very similar to the stock market cycles, and you see a lot of boom around the Stanley Cup playoffs. Mm-hmm. You'll see cards just skyrocket in price, and I'll take Braden Point, for example. His card 10x'd in value when Tampa went to the Stanley Cup Finals in the bubble the first year, and it bottomed, dropped out 50 to 70% afterwards. And it was just at that moment, the height, there was so much demand for his rookie card. You wanted to be in on it. He was having a phenomenal playoff run on a great team. Hockey was back. So there was lots of excitement. And it was interesting going into last season, that everyone saw the playoff hype, which was in that bubble, which was in the summer. And as the season started to go on, you saw prices just take off. And that's kind of where it lifted off. And I started really getting back into it right in the niche of that. So I started buying a few cards that I didn't realize, you know, 10x'd in value when I logged on to eBay or what have you. But you're right. Recently, the market's kind of shifted, and it's been interesting to watch. A lot of people were thinking start of the season, everyone's excited, looking forward to new cards coming out. And it was kind of underwhelming. There wasn't that spike that we saw the year before. And so people are wondering, okay, maybe it's after Christmas, there's going to be towards the playoffs. Maybe the Olympics will drive some focus on internationally on some stars that might normally not get the attention. And then the playoffs. I think the playoffs is where you'll see stars emerge. That's where everyone sees those names who fight for the Conn Smythe, whatever they may be. And they're the ones, the names that people are going to crave. When you see somebody putting up a hat trick in the playoffs, that's the card everyone's going to go out and buy on eBay that night. So it's kind of a matter of finding the trends, or if a player gets hot for 10 games. I know as a Sens fan, I held a lot of Drake Batherson cards that I bought for $5, $6, and I sold a couple for $50 when he went on his 7-game goal streak last year. And just that's the nature of it, right? And so it's finding those trends, and it, you know, will it appreciate long-term? Likely, I think it will, like anything, as the economy grows and inflation and everything. But the spikes, it's really ebbs and flows, as with anything.
We kind of touched on it a little bit too. For those that don't know, companies like Upper Deck and all of that are just absolutely slammed, and shortage of photographers and printing and all yeah. of that. So pretty much any initial date they threw out there for, oh, this set is going to be released at this date, yeah. like just throw that right out the window. Like normally this time of year, we're in early November. We've got big card expos coming up in Toronto. Like they've normally had their flagship Upper Deck Series 1, that's cream of the crop rookies, have been out. People are already trying to get their wish list. They've pushed back the date, but it's even sounding like their pushback date probably still isn't going to end up happening. I would bet that they somehow scramble and get it together out in time for Christmas. But yeah, if we look at that Series 1, that's always where you find the big rookie names. Like, who are some names in Series 1 that you are really looking forward to trying to get your hands on? Who are the chase cards this year amongst the NHL rookie crop?
I think it's really interesting, because had you asked me this about a month ago, I would have said Cole Caulfield, mm-hmm. but he's in the minors right now. And so I don't know how much more demand there is. I think there's still lots of hype around Cole Caulfield. And the fact that there's no checklist out yet means there's still some doubt. Will we see Quinton Byfield? Probably. But he's been injured, so maybe they're going to push him to Series 2. You've got the likes of, you know, Shane Pinto here in Ottawa. I think he's one that'll be desirable. Looking at it from a market standpoint of desirable rookies, it really comes down to Canadian markets drive the hockey card industry. Mm-hmm. And I would say Canadian markets and first overall draft picks, because Alexi Lafreniere still commands a pretty penny. And you look at his production compared to others, and, you know, at times his card was going for a lot more than Kaprizov's was, mm-hmm. You know, not maybe when it was released, but later on, it leveled out and the production was nowhere near the same. And, you know, it's also New York. I would say New York is one of the top markets for hockey cards in the States. So you look at Toronto rookies, Ottawa rookies, Calgary rookies, Montreal rookies, any of the Canadian teams, that's where you'll find the chasers, the hunts. I've seen pre-sales on eBay for Cole Caufield Young Guns of a couple hundred dollars already. And, you know, maybe they're regretting that now, seeing that he's sent to the minors. But that's definitely the one that always is headlined. When Upper Deck sent out a teaser last year, or earlier, I guess, this year, it was Cole Caufield on the front of the card.
Yeah.
So he's definitely, I think, the one that they're going to promote, and he'll be that first young gun, which is the rookie card there. And generally the one that is the first one on the checklist is the main chase that year for that set.
Yeah. And people always range in what they collect, right? People go from, I collect everything under the sun, every sport, every player, every whatever, to I only collect a certain player from a certain team, from a certain brand, and like uber specifics there. Like, where do you fall on that spectrum of collecting?
I fall somewhere down the middle. I have a good, a fellow person who creates content, YouTuber on YouTube, who has over 400 Eric Brandstrom cards, and is just a huge PC of Eric Brandstrom cards. I've seen a lot of them. He's actually sent me a few, because I do collect all the Senators cards. So I focus primarily on Ottawa Senators cards, mainly current stars or any former ones that I have a bit of a tie to, or, you know, pulls on the heartstrings of my childhood, the Chris Phillipses, the Daniel Alfredsons, Jason Spezzas, those players. I also do really enjoy some of the vintage cards. So if I can get my hands on some really nice vintage cards, I'll do that as well. But primarily when it comes to that, I'm looking for autograph cards. So I want a vintage autograph card, and I'll just find one for a certain player, and I'll want that one just as to hang on to, say, I've got a Gordie Howe autographed card, right? That means something to me. And aside from that, other than Ottawa Senators cards, there's one player I collect outside of that, and that's Shea Theodore for the Vegas Golden Knights, which might be some random name, but I think he's a phenomenal player. I think he's very underrated. I enjoy watching him play. And so I decided I wanted to collect his cards. So I built up a little collection of his cards as well.
And all cards are not made equal is a fairly obvious
absolutely
statement, but people kind of overlook that, especially when they are new to the hobby, right? So people who are going out there and just, oh well, this pack of cards is $40 and this one over here is only 10, like, what's the difference? They're both, you know, whatever, OPG, or they're both Upper Deck or whatever, I'll just grab the cheaper one. But that's where people will often spend a lot of money, whether it's retail or online purchases, and end up with cards that really hold value down the road. So if you were to really just dumb it down to maybe like one or two points, as far as like, if you were to talk to a new collector, I have zero cards in my collection, I want to get involved in it, like, what are the things to look for? What are the things to watch out for? What makes a card hold value more so over a different series, for example?
I think the biggest thing is rookie cards are always sought after. Rookie cards and superstar cards are always sought after. And so the name of the player obviously matters, but with every set that comes out, there's most often, I won't say always, but most often, 99% of the time, there's a base card. Mm-hmm. And the base cards generally hold little value, especially in I'll call them economy or the lower tier products. They really hold no value. So if you've got a Connor McDavid card, it's not going to hold any value because there's so many produced. And so that's kind of the first thing, is there's always base cards, but it's the insert. So where you generally get one per pack and it's shoved into the middle of your base cards, that's the card that will hold some value. And the value ranges based on a few factors. There's generally four factors, but it's, if it's a rookie card, if it's got an autograph, if it's got some memorabilia in it, whether it's a patch or what have you, and if it's serial numbered. And the serial numbered, the scarcity, that's what drives a lot of value. And I think that one is a bit underlooked when it comes to card values, because we really don't know how many rookie cards are produced each year. Like, that's not a known number. And there's lots of talk around, you know, Connor McDavid's rookie card. It seems like it's selling for a low price when you consider what are, you know, Wayne Gretzky obviously was many years ago, but for a player of his caliber, you can pick up a rookie card for $600-$800 right now. And it just seems, you know, compared to rookie cards of the, you could arguably say the best that ever played the game, you know, in other sports or even in hockey, you look at Wayne Gretzky cards or, you know, Gordie Howe cards, it just doesn't add up. And there's a lot of rumors that maybe in that year, they knew McDavid was going to be so highly sought after that they printed so many more cards. Mm-hmm. And because it's not serial numbered, there's not, you don't know how many are out there. So that's why McDavid's serial numbered rookie cards are so valuable, because you know that there's only 20 or 50 or 100 or 200 of that specific card that exists.
Yeah. So people kind of fall into one stance or the other as far as how to go about collecting, right? There's the old school, I'm going down to my local card shop, I'm buying packs, I'm ripping wax, I'm doing all that, versus the, well, why would I spend, whatever, $60 on a box to get no cards that I ended up wanted when I could spend $60 online and end up with two rookie cards of my favorite player or something like that, right? So where do you fall on that spectrum? Are you a little bit of both where you'll pick up some things that you need for your collection online, or are you an absolute purist and if I didn't pull it myself, I don't want it?
I definitely fall down the middle. I think for me, I get the enjoyment of and the fulfillment of opening the packs myself. It's entertaining. I film every single one because, one, if there's a defect or if something's wrong with it, I want to make sure Upper Deck, whoever made the card, can see that there was something wrong with it, especially if it was a really good card. I like to just share my love and enjoyment of the hobby with everyone. And secondly, if there's cards that I want, I'm going to go out and buy them, because that's just the way I am. And so Tim Stützle, you know, one of the Senators' top prospects, I've been wanting some of his cards and I've had no luck. You know, I've opened some products, I haven't been able to get any of his cards, but I was able in the summertime when prices dropped, as I said, kind of the lull in the market, I picked up a few of his cards that I really wanted. So definitely down the middle. It is a bit more of a gamble, I would say, nowadays. Opening boxes is much more like gambling, I think, mm-hmm. than it was in the past, just with the cost of prices. You can, you know, Upper Deck the Cup is arguably the most expensive product out there, selling for almost $2,000 a box. You get six cards in it. Nice. So it's really a gamble. You know, if you pull a card of a rookie on New Jersey who, you know, might make the fourth line one day, well, you know, is that really going to get you back $300 or $400? Probably not. Yes. So it's a lot more gambling these days with that. And I think that's why you're seeing a lot more action on the secondary market.
Yeah, no, it's definitely almost like going down to the local convenience store and picking up a scratcher ticket. You might hit it big,
exactly.
Or it might just be a thanks for playing, try again, right? Like,
exactly.
You're getting there. But
yeah,
what's the best card that you've ever personally pulled from a pack?
So it's interesting that you asked that, because I would say the best card I've pulled from a pack, because the other aspect is, I don't know if you're how familiar you are with Upper Deck EPAC. So EPAC is Upper Deck's online store, and I've opened up some boxes there. I've pulled a Jack Hughes rookie card on there. I have, that's actually where I pulled a Tim Stützle, the only place where I've pulled his rookie card. I personally pulled a Kaprizov rookie card myself that was out of wax at home on release day of the product, which was pretty exciting and probably the best pull I've had. I've had some really cool cards that to me mean a lot that I've pulled. I opened up some vintage tribute cards, pulled a Luke Robitaille autograph that I just thought was really, really cool. Serial numbered to 20. So that's just, to me, he's a player that in his day playing on the LA Kings was, you know, one of the best there. So the cards like that for me have been some of my best cards, but I've definitely gotten and sought out like some of the top cards I've got, just because the chance of me pulling it, I'm going to spend a lot more money trying to open up packs and may not even reach the card I'd want at that time.
Well, it used to be too that everyone would be trying to complete the full set. So you would want all 396 cards in the OPG sets to say that I got all of them in the whatever, the 1984-85
series. Yeah.
Now, though, it seems to have shifted from people collecting entire sets to it's just looking for those chase cards. It's looking for the big hits, the, as you said, the autographs, the rookies, the patches, the serial numbered cards. Has the market kind of changed, or do you still know people who are still out there trying to complete, you know, 1 through 500 of Upper Deck Series 1 and 2 base cards. Like, do full collectors still exist, or are they a dying breed these days?
They definitely still exist. I think you'll find a lot of them, I think, on YouTube. But a lot of the, they try and build their sets and, you know, they're sharing that love online. I think the market with the rise in prices brought a lot of investors into the space. So they have really driven the market for chase cards, for flipping of cards. And that's really brought a much different aspect into and a lot more volatility, I'd say, to the market. But I personally still enjoy, like, I've got binders of every base card from Series 1, Series 2, the last few years. I'm still collecting it this year. I think some of the, there are sets that are more collectible in terms of building the full set than others, like your Upper Deck Series 1s. Tim Hortons just got released recently. It's always a really fun set to collect. I love collecting Tim Hortons cards, going and grabbing a coffee and a couple packs of cards. It's always, always a blast. And I love collecting those sets. I think those are some of the most collectible ones as well. So I think, is it a dying breed? Maybe, but I think it's maybe more so just the waters are muddied with a lot more investors, and there's more people in the space now who aren't so interested in having a binder, and they want, you know, a couple really high-end cards in a one touch or graded or what have you.
Curious to get your take on what the long-term market will be for the Tim Hortons cards, because if you look back historically through hockey cards, like, there haven't been a lot that have been included in whatever, you know, Parker's Quaker Oats, or, you know, like, there's always been cards that have been associated with soups and stuff like that through the years. But here we are in the year 2021, and there's maybe a handful of select ones that people still look at. Like, what do you think 20 years down the line, people will look back on these Tim Hortons cards as, like, are they going to retain value, or is this just a, well, it's fun in the moment, but if you're hoping to squirrel them away for a, you know, investment down the line, you might as well set your money on fire.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know I in my old binders, I've got some early 2000s McDonald's cards, you know, from when McDonald's had hockey cards.
Yeah.
And there's a few that I think now are starting to get a little bit more traction and value. I actually bought a few recently from the 98, I think, McDonald's set. It's actually Wayne Gretzky with his father, the late Walter Gretzky. And it's one of the few hockey cards out there with both Wayne and his dad. So it's just a cool card that has some meaning, especially now that Walter's passed, right? And he was so iconic to the game. So I think cards like that will hold some value long term. The other aspect I think that's really important is the Tim Hortons set is Canada exclusive. Mm-hmm. So what I've noticed a lot is the demand, especially on the secondary market, comes from the United States. So there is a lot of value in the rarer cards that, you know, you might pull one every 20 or 25 packs, which generally when it's Tim Hortons is a hologram card. Mm-hmm. And those cards are often more desirable. And every year they have a Tim Horton card, right? It's the first card of the set. It's the first card of the red variation of the set. And those ones are often a little bit more sought out as well. In general, I think complete sets of Tim Hortons will be more valuable than individual cards down the road, because I think being like, I've got the 2019, 2020 full set of Tim Hortons is a lot more desirable than having one insert from Tim Hortons back in the day. So I think that's where I say, as a set builder, this is one of the best sets to collect, because I think as a whole set, Tim Hortons has their own branded binder, you know, that's the set to collect.
What's the biggest thing that you've learned as you've sort of transitioned now just from a kid who just liked ripping open hockey packs to you're now a content creator, you're now trying to sell some of these things, you're looking for investment pieces and that, like, what was the big thing that really helped you grow your set as far as transitioning from just enthusiast to where you are now?
So my first day that I'd say I got back into it in the pandemic was probably May of 2020, April or May of 2020. And I just bought a bunch of boxes. They were on sale. I just was like, I'm just going to get back into it, rip a bunch. I sat there with my now wife and we just opened up a bunch of packs and just went through it all together. And it was a lot of fun. And then from there, I started, you know, looking online and just started putting everything I opened online. And from there, I got involved in the community. It's a great community of people online. I joined some Discord groups. And I just started to chat with other collectors, some that had just gotten into it, some that have been doing it for a few years, some their whole lives. And it's just gaining the knowledge from all of them. And I think some of the biggest things I learned is, well, one, with the skyrocketing prices, is it's really important to have a budget and to know that it is a little bit of a gamble when you're opening cards, and you shouldn't be in there to chase for all these cards and buying it, because you see a lot of people spending a lot of money. And one of the things that I have gotten into a little bit, but I stay away from a little bit more now, is group breaks. Mm-hmm. It's a very common thing run by hobby shops and a lot of people online now, eBay, Facebook, where you pay $30 for a spot, you get one team, and any of the cards from that team you get. And there's always a chase to it, but more often than not, you're going to lose out. And it's one of those things that I thought that was a great deal at the beginning. And it's, you know, as I got through it, I realized that's a terrible idea. It's not as good as it seems. Some are not bad, and it's fun as like a gamble once in a while, but it's not a way to build your set or build your collection. It's better to, if you like certain cards, to buy those cards, save up for those cards that you really like. And if you really enjoy opening the cards, if that's what gives you the thrill, do it for the sake of opening it and not for the chase. The chase is what's fun, but don't do it expecting to hit or make your money back, because you're always going to be disappointed in the end from that.
Amazing. Brad, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us tonight. For those that want to maybe check out your YouTube channel or see any of the content you're putting out there these days, where are the best places to find you?
Yeah, so TSG Cards on YouTube or TSG Cards on Instagram. Haven't been active on Instagram very much, but I'm looking to start sharing my set. I've actually just gone through a whole reorganization of my collection, taking pictures and kind of inventorying everything. So I'm going to start sharing all of that on there. And any products or boxes or mail that I get relating to hockey cards, I post it on my YouTube channel. So anything and everything I open, you can find on there.
Beautiful. Well, best of luck to you as we continue to wait for the 2021-2022 set, but don't go too crazy ahead of this Christmas with the whenever they do release them.
Exactly. Awesome. Thanks, Kyle, for having me.
And that's a wrap for another episode of the Dine Sports Podcast on the Dine Sports Podcast Network. As always, a huge thank you goes out to all three of our guests today, Brendan, Mike, and Brad, for stopping by and talking all things Red Blacks, all things CFL, hockey, sports cards, and more. If you like what you heard, make sure to toss us a follow across any of our social media pages. All of our handles are the same. They're all at Dine Sports across all major platforms. You can also check out our YouTube page, where we are constantly uploading behind-the-scenes content, exclusive interviews, and more. So if you haven't already, check that out. Toss us a subscription on there as well, too. Till next time, folks, stay safe. We'll see you in a bit. We'll be right back.